I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, it's been 39 years since the Supreme Court's landmark Roe v. Wade case that legalized abortion in most cases, but it's still the subject of heated debate. We'll have a conversation with three young women who tell us how they are thinking through this important issue in their own lives. We'll hear that conversation in just a few minutes. But first, we want to take a look at one of this weekend's biggest matchups. And no, it has nothing to do with football. Over the weekend, voters in South Carolina went to the polls in that state's Republican presidential primary. After the votes were tallied, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich walked away with the big win. Now, if you've been keeping score, that's three different winners in three different states. Former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum in Iowa, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney in New Hampshire, and now former Georgia Congressman, the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, in South Carolina. We wanted to get a sense of what this means for the GOP field and for the rest of the race, so we've called on our trusted political team. Cynthia Tucker is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and she's now a journalism professor at the University of Georgia. Mary Kate Carey is a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. She's also a former presidential speechwriter. She worked for President George H.W. Bush. Thank you both so much for being with us once again.
Great to be here.
Good to be here, Michelle.
Such a busy weekend for political news, but we have to start in South Carolina. So, Mary Kate, let me just play a short clip of some of what Newt Gingrich had to say Saturday night after his big win.
We don't have the kind of money that at least one of the candidates has. But we do have ideas, and we do have people. And we proved here in South Carolina that people power with the right ideas beats big money. And with your help, we're going to prove it again in Florida. Thank you. Good luck, and God bless you.
Now, what you didn't hear is that we didn't play this part of it, but I know you heard it, is that in a lot of his speech, he was very conciliatory toward his other rivals. But that is not the tone he took in the last debate leading up to the primary.
No, not at all.
He was very fiery, very aggressive, very combative, especially toward the media, the questioner, John King in particular, of CNN. So I just want to ask you, so Mary Kay, a lot of people are attributing that debate performance to contributing to this late surge that took him over the top in South Carolina. Do you think that that's true?
Oh, yeah. The exit polls showed that two out of three South Carolina voters said debates matter. One out of two said that they made up their mind at the last minute. As you know, there was a debate, you know, right up to the last minute there, and I think it had a huge effect. It plays to Newt Gingrich's strong suit to be in so many debates, and it doesn't cost him any money. All he's got to do is pay for his plane ticket to the debate. So.
Well, but tell me why you think that that was so effective. And one of the things that I think is worth noting is that he led by a wide margin among people who are sort of self-described religious, right, evangelical Christians. There was little gender gap, that despite the speculation that the allegations raised by his second wife,
right,
former wife Marianne, that he cheated on her, that he was a serial adulterer, that he
wanted
an open marriage.
Right.
And even after she announced that she was ill, and it didn't seem to matter that he did beat other candidates by a larger margin among men, but was tops among women as well, including among married women.
Yeah, that is contrary to the gender gap polling that was going on before the primary took place. Going into it, Mitt Romney was ahead with women by 2 points. Newt Gingrich was down by 12 points with women. And then all of a sudden, it flipped around. I think it was a lot of things. Part of it was Rick Perry pulling out of the race and shifting his momentum over to Gingrich. I think part of it was Huntsman dropping out. I think part of it was some of these super PAC ads, which I assume we can talk about further as well. But I think basically the Marianne Gingrich story, I wrote a blog about this Friday. The thing that gets people upset about that story is not the prurient interest of, you know, somebody's sex life or their marriage or whatever. It's that Newt Gingrich doesn't play by the rules the rest of us play by. And in some ways, that's a good thing. And I think that's what you saw in the debates, going after the media and stuff like that. But when it comes to character and values, it may be a bad thing. I think people were willing to overcome that because they saw that debate performance and liked the rule breaker part of him in that situation. I think that's what carried him in the end.
So, Cynthia, who do you think President Obama's team – how do you think President Obama's team is reading this? What do you make of it?
Well, I think that President Obama's team is still planning to face off against Mitt Romney as the eventual nominee. And I think they're right about that because of Romney's organizational strengths. going into Florida. Florida's a big state, a much bigger state population-wise than any of the previous three states where Republican primaries or caucuses have been held. There are also several major media markets in Florida, which means that candidates can't do the kind of retail politicking that they have relied on in the past. Mitt Romney has money. He's already spent money in Florida. He's already opened several offices in Florida. And Newt Gingrich has very little money. Having said that, let me say that Romney faces a couple of weaknesses in Florida he didn't have before. One, obviously, is Newt Gingrich's new momentum. But the other is that one of the things, not only did Newt Gingrich have a good debate performance in that last South Carolina debate, but Mitt Romney had a poor performance. He still hasn't learned how to talk about his wealth and specifically his taxes. He plans to release his tax returns this week, and perhaps by the next debate, which is tonight, I believe that there will be a Republican debate, Mitt Romney will have better answers on his taxes and how he's made his money.
Cynthia Tucker is a journalism professor and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Mary Kate Carey is a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. We're checking in on the news, the political news of the weekend, which continues, Cynthia, because the State of the Union address is tomorrow night. How important is this for the president? I mean, right now, it's been really all he's had to do is kind of stand back and let the Republicans fight among themselves. Really,
right.
He sort of said that. So, Cynthia, what do you think about tomorrow night? And Mary Kate, you know I'm dying to hear from you because you actually wrote the Republican response one year.
I did.
Which none of us can say. So, Cynthia, what do you think? What tack do you think the president should take tomorrow night?
More than other recent speeches that the president has given, the State of the Union address this year will be a curtain raiser on his campaign. Very few observers don't expect that the president will sound the same themes that we're going to be hearing from him all year as his campaign themes. He's going to be populist. He's going to talk about the economy because that is still the number one issue. And he will invite a clear contrast between himself and Republicans. Most Democrats believe in an activist government, that government can help with just the right combination of incentives and regulations that the government can help produce a vigorous economy. And that's one of the things to look out for in President Obama's State of the Union speech. He will say that Republicans believe you go it alone, free market, winner take all, losers, left is roadkill, and I don't believe in that.
And Mary Kate, what do you think that the Republicans need to do in their response as a person who's actually written one of those?
Yeah, back in the day, I wrote the first State of the Union response by a woman, which was Governor Christy Todd Whitman. It was the first State of the Union after the Republicans took over in 94. And she was also the first governor to ever do it. Now governors do it all the time. So tonight's State of the Union response will be by Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana. As you recall, last year Paul Ryan did it. The year before that, not so good, Bobby Jindal. And so it's a way for the party to spotlight their up-and-coming backbenchers. And so I think this is not great necessarily for Romney to have Mitch Daniels suddenly getting a lot of attention tomorrow night. We've got a debate tonight, as Cynthia mentioned. We've got another debate Thursday night. And I think there's just going to be a lot of interesting political rhetoric this week. There's rumors.
It keeps kind of reinforcing this anybody but Mitt feeling.
Yeah.
Even though Mitch Daniels, the Indiana governor, took himself out of the presidential campaign for personal reasons. He just said he didn't want to subject his family to it for reasons we don't have time to go into. So,
right.
But again, but the Tea Party, once again this year, is also offering another response. And Herman Cain is going to be giving this one. What do you think about that?
I mean, well, last year it was Michelle Bachmann, if you recall, and CNN covered it live. The networks did, I guess, all of them. This year, it's not so clear whether they're going to carry it live again and have two State of the Union responses. So that remains to be seen. But I think the reason they picked Herman Cain was because of the 999 plan, and they want to talk about keep the focus on taxes. I think most Republicans are hoping the president will come out tonight and endorse Simpson-Bowles and take it back off the shelf. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's too much to ask. But that would be a game changer in my mind if he brought Simpson-Bowles back on the table.
Which is a bipartisan deficit reduction plan that a bipartisan committee could not sort of advance through its own.
The president appointed but then didn't enact his recommendations.
Well, Cynthia, before we let you go, we only have a minute left, so you have to be brief. But, you know, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords announced over the weekend that she's stepping down. She says she needs to focus on her recovery after the terrible shooting in her district, you know, last year. I know that you feel she's played an important role in our politics. What do you think her exit from the national stage means, though?
Well, Democrats are a little worried about holding onto her seat. Nobody can blame Gabby Giffords for making the move that she made. She's made a remarkable recovery so far, but she still has a ways to go. Nobody can blame her for focusing on her personal health. But Democrats were hoping that her husband would step up and declare that he would run for her seat. He's become a popular figure in his own right. Arizona is a state that has traditionally been Republican, has been trending a little bit more toward the Democrats, but it could fall back into Republican hands unless a very popular Democrat runs.
But there doesn't seem to be that members are saying that they're going to sit together as they did last year, kind of in her honor. We'll see if that changes anything the temperature there. Mary Kate Carey is a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. She's a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. She was here with us in Washington, D.C. Cynthia Tucker is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a journalism professor at the University of Georgia. She joined us from member station WUGA in Athens, Georgia. Ladies, thank you so much.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, if you've ever cared for an elderly parent or needed care yourself, you know it can be an overwhelming and exhausting experience. Our next guest has some wisdom to share that we hope will be helpful. We'll speak with Jane Gross. She's the author of A Bittersweet Season, Caring for Our Aging Parents and Ourselves. That's a little later in the program. But first, we wanted to spend some time talking to women about an issue that still fires some of the most intense political disagreements of our time. That issue is abortion. Despite dreary skies, demonstrators are in the nation's capital today for the March for Life, the annual event marking the anniversary of Roe versus Wade. That's the 1973 Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion. The debate over abortion rights is still raging in state legislatures. A new report by the abortion rights group NARAL, Pro-Choice America, says that in 2011, some 69 new laws were passed around the country that made it more difficult for a woman to get an abortion. That's just one short of the record for new restrictions that were set in 1999. To mark this anniversary, we thought it would be a good idea to hear from those who are most likely to be affected by the legal status of abortion, that is to say, young women. 51% of women who have abortions each year are 24 years old or younger, according to the latest data available from the Guttmacher Institute. That's a research group that focuses on reproductive and sexual health issues. We have with us today three young women who were born well after Roe v. Wade was decided, but whose lives continue to be touched by that decision. Joining us now, Kelsey Hazard. She is a law student at the University of Virginia. She founded a group called Secular Pro-Life, a group that opposes abortion rights. Mara Hollander is a senior at Georgetown University here in Washington, D.C. She supports abortion rights. And Lauren McEwen is a senior at Howard University, which is also in Washington, D.C. She's the life and style editor for that campus's newspaper, The Hilltop. Welcome to you all. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to start with you, Kelsey, because you are active in this issue.
I certainly am.
And I wanted to ask how you got interested in the issue and how you arrived at the position that you have now. Did you grow up with it?
You know, I really didn't grow up with it. You know, my parents certainly inculcated me with certain values about treating other people the way that you want to be treated and caring for weaker members of society. But they really didn't talk to me specifically about abortion, and they weren't, you know, activists in any way. For me, it really has to do with the science and human rights-based arguments against abortion. You know, if someone is a human being and science tells us that the unborn are, I'm just very, very uncomfortable with making these political distinctions that a certain age group or ethnicity group or whatever group, however you're going to define it, that a certain group isn't going to have a right so basic as the right to life.
Mara, what about you? You support abortion rights for women. How did you arrive at your point of view?
I do support abortion rights. I think abortion rights are important for women. I grew up surrounded by a lot of strong women who taught me that women should be able to make their own decisions and have a certain level of bodily autonomy, that is the ultimate level of bodily autonomy, to decide what happens to them in their existence. And as I grew older, this became more and more important to me. I think, while I respect Kelsey referring to the science, I do think the science is not as clear as some people will suggest. I think when people talk about life beginning at conception, I do not believe that. And because I do not believe that life begins at conception, because I don't think the science demonstrates that life begins at conception, women should be able to make their own decisions.
Did your parents grow up with this? I asked Kelsey this question too. Did you grow up with it? Were your parents talking to you about this?
My parents did talk to me about it. I think when I was younger, it was harder for me to understand. I think that abortion is a bit of a complicated issue. So just being told by my parents was helpful, but it wasn't enough for me to understand. I really had to come into the beliefs on my own, I think.
Interesting. Okay. And Lauren, you know, we're glad you're here because a recent survey from the Pew Research Center found that most Americans, actually 60%, fall somewhere in the middle when they're asked whether they think that abortion should be legal or illegal. And also, as an African-American, African-Americans tend to have an interesting perspective on this. They tend to believe for themselves personally that abortion is not the right choice, but they don't tend to think they can make that choice for other people. And I understand that that's kind of where you are.
That's exactly where I am. My mother always raised me not to believe that abortion was really an option for myself, mostly because she never wanted me to feel that kind of guilt. And she just was afraid of girls like making that kind of decision and then regretting it later.
Do you have an opinion that you claim as your own about this?
Definitely. I just think it's very easy to be either or when you're not in this situation. Luckily, I haven't had to face that kind of decision, and knock on wood, just God forbid. But I don't know what I would do.
I understand. I'd like to just politely disagree with Lauren a little bit. And I know that every person is different, but among my pro-life friends and activists who I know, a lot of them have become even stronger in their views or come to the pro-life position as a result of personally experiencing pregnancy.
You have had friends who've had what we would call unplanned or
yes.
What some people would call crisis pregnancies?
Oh, yes.
And did they all choose to keep the children, to your knowledge?
Not all, no. Some, I do know people who have had abortions, and that doesn't prevent me from being friends with them. I know a lot of pro-life people who have had abortions. You know, they were pro-choice, they had an abortion, and then through that experience wound up, you know, getting to a point where they said, I don't want any other woman to have to go through what I've been through.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. It's been 39 years since the Supreme Court's Roe versus Wade decision legalized abortion to some extent in this country. I'm joined by three young women with different perspectives on abortion rights. They were all born after the decision, well after the decision, but they're living with it now. Lauren McEwen is a student editor of the Howard University newspaper. Mara Hollander is a student at Georgetown University and is an abortion rights supporter. And Kelsey Hazard is a law student at the University of Virginia and founder of a group called Secular Pro-Life. You know, one of the interesting things about Mara and Kelsey, that both of you who are activists and have strong points of view on this issue, is that you each said you started with a position and then you studied more that reinforced the position you already had.
Yes.
And I'm curious about, Mara, if that tells us something about why we continue to fight over this.
Yeah, I mean, I think people become very ingrained in their positions on these issues. Obviously, it's a very complicated issue. If you do believe that life begins at conception, I do see where Kelsey is coming from. If you do believe that life begins at conception, it would be very, very difficult to sit across the table from me while I'm saying that abortion is okay. That said, because I don't believe that life begins at conception, most of the arguments that I see support my point of view. And I think that is at the very heart of the abortion debate.
Let me ask you this. So Kelsey said that she has met people, she's known people who have had abortions, and she can still be friends with them. What about you? Can you still be friends with somebody who has a very strong position against yours, who feels that women should not have the right to choose abortion?
I definitely am. One of the great things about being at Georgetown is that I'm surrounded by people with all sorts of political views. It is a Catholic, a Jesuit university where the position is
one of
a pro-life position. There are a lot of pro-life conferences on campus. And I do have friends who are very strongly pro-life and who will be attending the march and some of the rallies this week. I'm still friends with them. I don't think I would go to them were I in a situation where I felt I needed to make a choice. And that's unfortunate to me.
Kelsey, can I ask you a question? Because this is something that came up when, you know, Sarah Palin was running for, was on the ticket to be vice president of the United States. And she, Mrs. Palin, Sarah Palin, as a public position, strongly opposes Roe versus Wade and does believe it should be repealed. And the argument that her critics have made of her is that, see, this is, your conviction about this arises from the fact that you have a choice. Does that make sense?
To me, it really doesn't, because, I mean, she did. She did give birth to that child, and her and Bristol did give birth to that child, because they were not going to deny the right to life of their children, even if the law of the land is that other children may not have those rights. They were going to say, well, this is my public position, and I'm going to live my private life in consistently with that. I think that's not hypocritical at all.
I think the argument that some people make, that critics make, is that what's wrong with the position that Lauren has enumerated, which is that if that's your personal conviction, that's fine for you. But why do you feel you have the right to deny others the right to make a decision that's best for them? I think that's the argument.
What I would say to that is simply that if you look at abortion as a violation of the rights of the fetus, then it's not enough to just say, well, you know, it's up to you, it's your choice, because there's another individual in the mix here who doesn't have a voice in the decision. And because of that, the legal system has to step in to protect those individuals, even if their parents, you know, do not want to step up and take that position.
Lauren, you wanted to add something.
I do. I just struggle with that because of the fact that 9 times out of 10, when most young women especially are thinking of aborting a baby, they're thinking about this because they're afraid that they can't provide for that child because of their status in life.
That's absolutely true. I do understand that. And I think that the pro-life movement is making strides toward creating more resources, but that a lot of work needs to be done.
I just struggle with that.
Go ahead,
Lauren. I struggle with that because the majority of the people who I've spoken to who have usually been pro-life also don't support things like WIC and welfare for these mothers. So the only time the baby is actually important is when it's in the woman's womb. And I struggle with that. It's just a lot of people I've met. You might not feel that way personally, but I just struggle with that idea. Because most of the time, these are just girls who feel like they don't have any other option other than to either put their baby in foster care once they have it or to get rid of it while it's in their womb. And it's just so many girls who have done it before regret it, but they don't regret it because it hurts them to think about it again. But they don't regret it thinking that my child wouldn't be able to make it on what I make.
I think another important, this is Mara. I think another important factor to consider here is what is happening to the woman while she is pregnant. There is precedent that says that human beings cannot be forced to forgo their bodily autonomy for pretty much anything. You can't be forced to consent to a medical procedure if you are declared competent. You cannot be forced to donate an organ to another person, to give up a kidney, to donate blood. And one of the biggest issues that strikes me here is that we are, if it's even just for 9 months, even if you do have an option for foster care at the end of that, even if there are resources for women at the end, which I do think need to be there, you're still removing women of their bodily autonomy and their ability to make decisions for those 9 months.
What about those who would argue that, except in the cases of rape and incest, that the woman made the choice to have sex, and therefore the consequences of that she should be responsible for?
I think that sexual development is different for a lot of different people. I think that some people can be healthy sexually while remaining abstinent, and that's great for those people. I think we also need to consider people who approach their sexual development differently. Some who use contraceptives incorrectly because they don't know how, they weren't taught. People who don't know how to use contraceptives at all and therefore don't use them. I think it's more complex than just the rape and incest issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Kelsey, would you respond to Lauren's point, which is that her perception is that a lot of the people she sees as being pro-life only care about the fetus as long as it's in the mother's womb, but don't care about it, the child after that, and don't seem to show any regard for the child's quality of life afterwards.
Right. I think that problem really arises from this political alliance that is somewhat strained, this political alliance between the pro-lifers and these fiscal conservatives. And that's done so that we can elect pro-life people to office. But pro-life pregnancy centers rely greatly on WIC. You know, pro-life pregnancy centers are connecting women in crisis to government programs. They rely on those things. So the pro-life movement, there is this tension in trying to get our representatives, especially the ones who are more fiscally conservative, to say, hey, you know, I realize that the budget is a mess, but these are vital programs, and you know, please don't eliminate them.
We only have a couple minutes left, and so before we let you go, this has been an interesting discussion. Obviously, we're not going to resolve this issue here that has bedeviled this country for, what, you know, 40 years, and in truly even before that. But I did want to ask each of you for a closing thought, and I think I'm interested in this whole question of if we were to get together. You all are very young. As I said, you're at the, of an age where, and I'm not going to ask each of you what you think you would do if faced with this. I mean, Lauren, you talked about that a little bit because it's a little personal. But I do wonder whether when you are no longer of the age when this is a pressing issue, when you're, you know, as we mentioned, a majority of the people who have abortions in this country are younger than 24.
Right.
5 years from now when we get together, 10 years from now, if we were to get together, where do you think we'll be?
That's a really interesting question. I do think that it's a more pressing issue for young people. We see a lot of young people at the March for Life. It's become a very youth-oriented issue. But I certainly think that I'll still be involved in the pro-life movement and working on those issues in 10 years, 15 years.
You think there will still be issues to work on?
Oh, absolutely.
You think the issue will still be with us?
Even if Roe v. Wade is overturned, then it just goes to the states. Even if abortion is outlawed entirely, then we still have to be working on resources for women and educating people about how to have a healthy pregnancy. There is always going to be pro-life work to be done.
Mara, what about you?
Well, I hope that this remains an issue in 10 or 15 years because I can't imagine this going in the direction I would like it to by then. So I hope that we're still discussing it. And I think that one area that it seems that all three of us have been able to agree on is that we'd like to see more resources for women throughout their pregnancies and as well as after. And I think that at least my personal opinion would be that it would be beneficial to work with pro-life advocates to on an issue in which you can all agree. Most of us can agree with just stopping pregnancy before it happens. And one of the in some of the myriad ways that we can do that include contraceptives, birth control, and for some people, abstinence, if that is a decision that works for them. Ultimately, though, I think that women do need to be able to have the choice. And I think that this probably will eventually go back to the states. And I hope that each state is going to make decisions that recognize where its women are and what kind of resources they have available to them.
Lauren, what about you?
I still think I'll still feel the same way. I still think that I'll feel that I don't agree with it for myself. But for other people, my friends who've come up to me and said, I'm thinking of doing this, I can't tell them no. I can't tell them that's not their right. And I still hope that we'll still have this option because I'm afraid that if we don't, women will turn to back alley people who will do things for them and will turn to alternatives that could leave them in more danger than actually having an abortion at Planned Parenthood or some welcome and friendly resource to them.
Do you think this issue will still be here 10 years from now?
I definitely do.
Because?
Just because people are always going to have unplanned pregnancies and people are always going to have situations where they might want to have an abortion. It's never that want and that need isn't going to go away, but our argument about it will still be here regardless of what happens.
Lauren McEwen is a senior at Howard University. Mara Hollander is a senior at Georgetown University. Kelsey Hazard is a law student at the University of Virginia, and she founded a group called Secular Pro-Life. She's actually here in Washington, D.C. today to attend the annual March for Life, and they were all here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Ladies, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a tribute to the legendary singer Etta James, who died on Friday at the age of 73. But first to our Wisdom Watch conversation. That's where we talk with people who've made a difference through their work. And today we speak with a woman who is rewriting the way we talk about aging and the end of life in this country. Award-winning journalist and author Jane Gross was a New York Times reporter for nearly 30 years. There she covered many major beats, including health. She's been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize 5 times. In recent years, she's focused her writing on the subject of aging. In 2008, she launched the New Old Age blog for the Times. She's also the author of the book, A bittersweet season, caring for our aging parents and ourselves. In it, she chronicles with brutal honesty the final years of her own mother's life and how she and her mother and brother coped. We included Jane Gross in Tell Me More's End of Life series this past fall, and we found that we had more to talk about. So she's back with us now. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me again, Michelle.
Just to kind of reprise a couple of the things we talked about, if people missed our earlier conversation, we mentioned that as a longtime reporter, you reported on a lot of things. You started as a sports reporter, you worked on lots of national stories, but you had been reporting on health, but not aging specifically. But as your mother began to age and you realized that she needed, you know, more help, did you think you were ready? Did you think you knew everything you needed to know?
No, but I thought as a reporter I was capable of finding out everything I needed to know. I didn't realize that the systems were so complicated that they were coupled with the sort of emotional baggage of it being your mother and your brother, that you couldn't just pick up the phone the way you did when you were a reporter and get an answer.
What was the hardest thing?
I think the hardest thing was feeling so stupid. Stupid about really basic things like what Medicare is and what our residential choices were and how stupefyingly expensive everything was. And also all the old family dust flies. And when there are siblings, you sort of become in the family who you were in the family as a child, as opposed to who you are in the family now.
Were you shocked that you were shocked by how
yes.
hard it was?
Yes. I thought that my level of competence and my brother's level of competence, and we're both journalists, coupled with my mother's level of competence as a retired registered nurse, she also was cognitively intact. So when it comes to her being part of the decision-making, we were extremely fortunate. If there was a family that had all the pieces in place to do this effortlessly, it was us, and I felt like I'd been hit by a truck.
Why did you feel like you had been hit by a truck?
Partly because of the ignorance I spoke of, and partly because of the fact that even if you know all the basics, there's a whole category of things that are going to depend completely on the trajectory of the aging. You can't know in advance how long it's going to last. You can't know in advance how much it's going to cost. And I'm the kind of control freak who likes to be able to make a list and check things off. Doesn't work that way.
We recently had the opportunity to speak with former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice on this program about her new memoir. She talks about the fact that when she was originally asked to join the George W. Bush administration as National Security Advisor, she said no. And the reason she said no is that her father had suffered a stroke and she didn't feel she could leave him. She recounts a conversation with a friend where she says, if I had children, people would understand it. But because I don't, and because this is my father, I don't think people would understand it. Do you think that that's true?
I think that that's fascinating. I hesitate to say categorically that I think it's true because I don't have children, and I think it would be presumptuous. Although what makes it so interesting to me as an example is when Hillary Rodham Clinton's mother died, I was really struck reading the obituary that I had no idea, and I read the newspaper every day, that her mother was nearing the end, which obviously she was. And a trip hadn't been made overseas for that reason, and she must have felt just the way Condoleezza Rice felt.
I mentioned that you were part of an earlier roundtable of adult children who've cared for their elderly parents. It was part of our end-of-life series, and you were nice enough to participate in that. I just want to share something, some feedback we got from a listener after the series. And she wrote in from Missouri, and then she said that she felt like the segment, quote, sounded a glossier view of what caregivers actually experience. She wrote about how hard her own life is as a caregiver. She talked just about how wrenching and exhausting it can be. And I just wanted to, you know, ask, you know, it's, we often don't get a do-over in this business, but I would like to say, do you agree that, is there something that we can share that we perhaps did not get to in that conversation that we really should tell people?
I thought it was wrenchingly difficult. I also thought in many ways it was redemptive because I was closer to my mother when it was over and I was closer to my brother than it was over. So at least at the back end, there was an enormous reward, if you will, in my case. Statistically, if you ask people, old people, where they want to end their lives, the answer is home. Not all of us, because of the size of our families, because of the difference in location, because of our professional situations, because of what's actually physically wrong with our parents, because of our relationship within our families, are able to do that. And my mother spent the last 2 years of her life in a nursing home, and a fabulous nursing home where she got remarkable, wonderful care. But I spent the 2 years leading up to that doing everything I could possibly do not to, quote unquote, put my mother away. Mm. And the guilt of that is excruciating. And the number of situations that I sort of jerry-rigged leading up to that in order to avoid that made it much harder for me and much harder for my mother, largely because she was in pretty. You don't have to feel so guilty as a daughter kind of assisted living type places that didn't look like a nursing home, didn't smell like a nursing home, didn't feel like a nursing home, but where there was no decent care. So every time the tiniest thing went wrong, they called an ambulance, which is really tough when you're the one following the ambulance to the emergency room once a week or so. And, you know, very tough for my mother. There was less of her, if you will, after each trip to the hospital.
What's the one thing you wish somebody had told you before your mother started to decline that would have helped you?
It's hard to boil it to one. I would say the other thing that I wish I had known was that Medicare, which most of us believe is universal health care for old people, and that no one explains to you beforehand is that it covers procedures and drugs and operations and doctors, but it doesn't cover custodial care. So if your mom is home and you need a home health aide, or you need somebody to drive her around, or you need somebody to help her unpack the groceries, Medicare covers none of that. And it's hugely expensive, and you pay for it out of pocket until you're impoverished. And then Medicaid, as a poverty program, picks it up. I wish I'd known that.
And one of the things we talked about is that, and you talk about in the book, is that you are very well-educated, you're smart, you're savvy, and you are kind of hit over the head with just how fast the bills kick in and how complicated these systems can be to navigate. Is there a broader lesson here that really we all need to clue into about the way these systems work or don't work?
Medicare was designed in 1965, and it was a perfectly wonderful health insurance system for old people in 1965 when they didn't live to these astounding ages. You know, if you were going to design Medicare knowing what we know now, I don't think we would design it in that way that bifurcates acute and chronic, because very old people, as a rule, don't need heart transplants. They need home health aides. So that would be number one on my wish list. I don't see it happening. Number two on my wish list would be that all of the different elements of this that you as the adult child have to understand, the entitlements piece, the medical piece, the residential piece, the legal piece, the financial piece, they all kind of exist in their own separate silos. And there's no central repository for information. You have to untangle each one of these, and I kind of visualize them as silos. You have to crawl inside each one of them separately and see how they work.
You know, finally, before we let you go, your book is called Caring for Our Aging Parents and Ourselves. The caring for yourselves part, is that something that a lot of people trip up on? Is it the kind of thing that causes resentment, that tears families apart? Is there something you can give some advice on about that?
Yeah, I think it's something that almost nobody succeeds at. And I didn't, frankly, do a very good job of it. It never would have crossed my mind to go on a four-day week had my mother's physical therapist not suggested it. And it was then my mother's nurse who said, don't tell your mother because she will feel so guilty that this is so hard for you and that it's going to cost you money, pension, benefits, all of that stuff. So, you know, protect her from feeling guilty. In retrospect, I think, you know, more than the managing your time or making sure you're exercising or eating or going to a yoga class or getting your nails done or, you know, whatever it is that relaxes you, if you will.
And giving yourself permission to do it, right?
Yeah, well, it's very hard to give yourself permission to do it. I actually think, and again, these generalizations are onerous, but I think men are better at compartmentalizing. And my brother was really great at doing what needed to be done and also really great at not worrying and obsessing in the in-between time. He sort of shut that part of his brain on and off and was just as effective as I was at the doing and much more effective than I was at taking care of himself.
But I do have to ask, and again, we're generalizing, is that because men don't expect to be and are not judged in the way that people judge women? If anything goes wrong, do people call the brother or do they call the sister? And who do they expect to show up first?
And then after you've done it all, who are all the little old ladies in the nursing home talking about all week but the brother who showed up for 10 minutes? So there's some of that. The one thing that I wish I had understood while it was going on is honestly, truly understanding that there's only one end result here. I mean, they're going to die. So every teeny little decision that's thrown your way to make ultimately doesn't matter that much. Ultimately, it's really more about being loving and witnessing what's going to happen, regardless of what you do. Presence is ultimately vastly more important than what you actually do or don't do.
Jane Gross is author of the book, A Bittersweet Season, Caring for Our Aging Parents and Ourselves. She joined us from New York. Jane Gross, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And we couldn't end our program today without taking a moment to acknowledge the passing of music legend Etta James. She died late last week from complications caused by leukemia at the age of 73. She built a career on the sheer power of her versatile voice, which shifted seamlessly between rhythm and blues, dreamy jazz, and straight-ahead pop. At just 15, she recorded the hit R&B duet Wallflower, also known as Roll With Me, Henry. James was born to a 14-year-old mother in Los Angeles. She was raised by foster parents who started her singing gospel music at an early age. Eventually, she signed with the Chicago label Chess Records, where she scored a big hit with her 1961 rendition of At Last. Now, that's a song you've probably heard at more than a few weddings, but her voice also sparkled on tracks like A Sunday Kind of Love.
I want a Sunday kind of love, a love to last past Saturday night.
Etta James will be remembered for her singing, but away from the stage, she could be erratic. She battled drug addictions that dogged her career. James discussed her darker moments in her autobiography, Rage to Survive, which was co-written with David Ritz.
She was wildly creative and wonderfully spontaneous and, you know, uncontrollable. She was an unmanageable kind of person. But she was different. She was different because she had such a sweet little girl in her and such a kind of a lovability about her that made you forget all the times when she wore you out.
Over her career, Etta James amassed 6 Grammy Awards, and she's been enshrined in both the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Blues Hall of Fame. She is survived by her husband of 42 years, Artis Mills, and her 2 children. And we will leave you with Tell Mama.
Tell Mama. All about it. Tell Mama.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
And I'll make everything all right.